This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for April 28, 2014. As usual, our friends at the Internal Revenue Service and the federal courts have given us plenty to talk about. Let's start with a new Form 1023 EZ, a simplified exemption application released in draft form that will allow charities to apply for charitable status, apply for reinstatement of charitable status by filling out only 2 pages in which they answer questions about what's in their controlling documents, instead of producing the controlling documents. Then in Ash Grove Cement, the Tenth Circuit affirmed a decision denying a tax refund for a corporation that spent money defending a merger. The court concluded that the expenses were related to the merger at a long-term benefit, which takes us, of course, back to the capitalization rules of 263. Then Harris Wang believed that the entire proceeds of a fellowship that he received were tax-free. Then he also believed, because he was working for an entity that received a tax-free federal grant, that the portion of it that was paid to him would be tax-free. He was mistaken, of course. Samir McHale, a physician who got involved in selling Amway, did not operate his Amway activity for a profit, which is not unusual. We see a lot of those. And then Revenue Procedure 2014-30, announcing inflation-adjusted amounts for health savings accounts under Section 223. And then a couple of Small Business and Self-Employed Division guidance documents. One, SBSE 05041400029, is interim guidance for collection employees that are working offer in compromise cases, supplementing previous guidance and explaining how to handle a lump sum offer, which is one that's payable in 5 months or less, or an installment offer, which is one that is payable in 6 to 24 months. And then finally, interim guidance on policies and procedures on suits to foreclose tax liens on real property, which is used by the taxpayer, the taxpayer's spouse, or the taxpayer's dependents as a personal residence. This, of course, is designed to be difficult. The tax collector cannot take your home without the specific approval of a federal judge and without specific circumstances. And we'll talk a little bit about what this guidance means. So, we have a lot to talk about. Let's get started. Our first item is the Form 1023-EZ, Streamlined Application for Recognition of Exemption under Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code. This 2-page draft was also accompanied by draft instructions. The notice described the draft as a shorter and less burdensome version of the 25-page Form 1023, and estimated that it might take 14 hours to complete the EZ form as opposed to 101 hours for the standard form. The draft instructions explain what should be in the necessary organizing documents. They explain the wording that should be in the organizing documents. And then the 1023EZ asks if your organizing documents are the same as the words that are in the instructions. Very handy, very efficient. Next, Ash Grove Cement. A decision from the United States Court of Appeals from the Tenth Circuit. A corporation was not entitled to a tax refund after the IRS disallowed business expense deductions that were related to the settlement of a lawsuit which involved claims properly characterized as capital expenditures. In a series of complex transactions, a family-controlled group became one corporation. In the process, there was a stock swap, and the controlling family of the various entities in the group received stock in Ash Grove in return for their shares in other corporations. But one Daniel Rader, who was a minority shareholder in Ash Grove, filed a class action complaint claiming that the reorganization constituted self-dealing by the members of the controlling family, that a purported special committee of the board was not meaningfully independent of the family, and that the transaction had unfairly diluted the minority shareholders' interests in Ash Grove. In other words, all of Mr. Rader's claims related to the reorganization and the validity and the terms under which the reorganization was done. That means the origin of the claim here was the reorganization itself. So when Ashgrove paid a settlement and paid legal fees, those were paid to defend the reorganization. You may recall that a few weeks ago in this program, we talked about Private Letter Ruling 2014-12-002, where the origin of the claim was the conduct of the corporate officers and directors that affected the value of shares both before and after a reorganization, and the IRS held in that private letter ruling that the expenses incurred to defend the officers and directors against claims that they had produced and published misinformation were not related to the reorganization, but were related to the ongoing business operation of the subject corporation. That meant that in the private letter ruling example, the origin of the claim was the ordinary and necessary business expense, which means expenses were deductible, whereas in Ashgrove, the origin of the claim was the reorganization itself. It's important to keep that difference in mind. Harris Wang received a fellowship grant, a stipend, and he was paid to do research work from the proceeds of a grant which was tax-free to the corporation that got the grant, but not tax-free to Mr. Wang. In 2009, the American Society for Engineering Education awarded Mr. Wang the National Defense Science and Engineering Graduate Fellowship. The fellowship grant paid all of Mr. Wang's tuition charges and mandatory fees in connection with his enrollment in a doctoral program at Harvard. In addition, they provided him with an additional cash stipend of $18,375. Mr. Wang only reported $8,208 of that amount as taxable, arguing that he had spent $10,167 to pay off student loans and certain other expenses related to his undergraduate and graduate studies. Unfortunately, he did not produce any receipts, bank, credit card records, or similar documentation to substantiate that claim. Further, in 2009, he had received some $30,000 as non-employee compensation as a researcher, which was reported to him on a 1099-M. Other income, medical study. Mr. Wang reported the income, but did not report any self-employment tax. Well, the company that got the tax-free grant from the federal government was run by his father. He produced a letter signed by his father, the elder Mr. Wang, stating that the corporation had paid young Mr. Wang the $35,000 in connection with its qualified therapeutic discovery project. The payment was reported in Box 3 in accordance with the instructions for that form. But then Mr. Wang's father went on to give the IRS some advice that Mr. Wang, the younger Mr. Wang, should not pay self-employee, Social Security, or Medicare taxes on the amount paid by the federal grant. He was mistaken, of course. So Mr. Wang had two items of additional taxable income. He had to pick up the remaining balance, the $10,000 and change of the cash stipend that he got in connection with his fellowship, and he had to pay self-employment tax on his $35,000 of income. He was engaged in the trade or business of medical research as an independent contractor, and the entire payment he received is compensation subject to the self-employment tax, is what the court concluded. Dr. Samir Mikkel was an osteopath who worked for the federal government in the VA medical program. He and his wife became Amway distributors somewhere along the way and claimed significant deductions in connection with that purported activity. But it turns out when you apply the 9-factor test, their Amway activity was not conducted in a businesslike manner or with the requisite profit objective. They did, however, rely on a CPA to whom they gave all of their information, who was fully informed about their Amway activity, and so the court refused to uphold the IRS's assessment of a penalty. The year under examination, when the expenses were finally disallowed, was the fifth year, and the CPA had faithfully prepared the returns for the first 4 years, claiming significant losses. Now, Dr. Mikkel worked for the Veterans Administration in a VA hospital. In 2009, he was paid $157,621, or thereabouts, right? But here, a couple of things from the recitation of the facts. He testified that he conducted independent research to learn more about Amway. He concluded that negative assessments about the Amway business model are attributable to individuals who did not follow the system. So the doctor was convinced that if he followed the system, he could make money selling Amway. The fact that he did not, apparently, did not dissuade him from continuing to try. It's worth noting that the losses ranged from a low of $6,000 a year to a high of $41,000 a year, usually toward the high end rather than the low end, totaling almost $200,000 over a period of 7 years. But there's one quote in particular that I wanted to share with you out of the discussion. Dr. McHale testified that the time he devotes to Amway activities is largely directed at recruiting new distributors. He further testified that he usually spends his lunch hour, as well as an hour or two after work, and approximately 3 hours every weekend on Amway activities, and that Amway is always at the forefront of his mind. This is just exactly why I wouldn't be too excited about getting medical care in the VA system if they have doctors where their Amway business is what is at the forefront of their mind. And oh, by the way, approximately 70 to 75% of the Amway sales volume that the doctor and his wife reported was attributable to products and services that they purchased for personal consumption, food, diapers, clothing, and household products. Plus, they enjoyed Amway-related discounts on products and services purchased by businesses and retailers that had affinity agreements with Amway, such as Disney, Sony, Nike, and Best Buy. A quick update on the inflation-adjusted amounts for health savings accounts. And yes, you can still have a health savings account in the era of the Affordable Care Act. The maximum deductible contribution for an individual covering only the individual's self is $3,350. Family coverage, the maximum deductible contribution, is $6,650. The definition of high deductible plan means, in the case of an individual, a plan with a deductible of not less than $1,300 and not more than $6,450. In the case of family coverage, not less than $2,600 and not more than $12,900. Next, guidance issued for IRS collection officers updating the guidance for Form 656, the offer in compromise, and the 656B, the whole contents of that offer in compromise booklet. In addition, there's an adjustment to the application fee amount. The update revised the number of months allowed for payment of the offer when a lump sum cash offer is submitted. And here are the new rules. Taxpayers submitting requests for lump sum cash offers must include with the offer a payment equal to 20% of the offer amount. The payment is treated as a payment of tax and is non-refundable. That is, it will not be returned even if the offer is deemed to be not processable, later returned, withdrawn, terminated, or rejected. A lump sum cash offer means any offer of payments to be made in 5 or fewer installments within 5 months of offer acceptance, unless there's an exception noted, and no point in talking about the exceptions. You can look at those if you'd like. Then there is the periodic payment offer. A periodic payment offer is payable in 6 or more installments, must be accompanied by the payment of the amount of the first proposed installment, and additional installments must be paid while the offer is being evaluated by the IRS. The total period for payment of installments may not exceed 24 months. There is also something in this guidance that you may find helpful, and that is the components of collectability. A definition of, for the purposes of evaluating an offer in compromise, a definition of assets, a definition of future income, a definition of amount collectible from third parties, and a definition of assets and or income that are available to the taxpayer but are beyond the reach of the government. If you have occasion to represent clients in collection matters, I believe it's important for you to know exactly what the IRS collection officer has been instructed to do and what guidance has been provided to the collection officer in order to effectively represent your client. Then, speaking of representing the client in collection matters, our last item this week is a Small Business and Self-Employed Bulletin 05-0414-0032. It provides guidance on policies and procedures for suits to foreclose tax liens on real property used as a taxpayer's principal residence or owned by a taxpayer and used as a principal residence by the taxpayer's spouse, former spouse, or minor children. There are two options for enforcing collection against the principal residence of a taxpayer or a residence which is owned by the taxpayer but occupied by the spouse, former spouse, or minor child. These options are mutually exclusive. One is a proceeding to obtain a court order allowing administrative seizure of a principal residence under Code Section 6334(e)(1). The other is a suit to foreclose the federal tax lien against a principal residence under Section 7403. The suit to foreclose is the secondary alternative used only when the seizure remedy is not the optimal solution. So let's suppose that we have a residence owned by the taxpayer, occupied by the taxpayer's disabled former spouse. The IRS is not going to seize the residence. They may foreclose and they may perfect their right to take the proceeds of sale of the residence at some future date, but they're not going to seize the residence, throw the disabled taxpayer's spouse, or throw the taxpayer's disabled former spouse out and sell the residence. It just isn't going to happen. In any event, no matter what, there are five steps that a revenue officer must take when considering foreclosing on a taxpayer principal residence. They must attempt to personally contact the taxpayer. They must attempt to identify the occupants of the principal residence. They must attempt to discuss administrative remedies with the taxpayer, including advising the taxpayer of the opportunity to submit an offer in compromise. They must advise the taxpayer about the taxpayer advocate service. And if the taxpayer indicates that the planned foreclosure of the principal residence would create a hardship, the revenue officer is required to assist the taxpayer with the preparation of a Form 911 and should forward that form to the local taxpayer advocate service if the revenue officer feels that on her or his own authority, they cannot or should not provide the requested relief. Finally, the revenue officer must write up a summary statement in the case history indicating what was done and why it was done or why it was not done. Well, there it is. That's it for this week. Thank you, and as always, stay safe.